Britain plans broader sanctions against Iran, but stops short of labeling its Islamist Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist group. A British-Iranian activist who wants that IRGC designation gives us her reaction to London's move.
It is a step forward. However, it is not recognizing them as a terrorist organization, and therefore we still need to continue with our campaign.
Plus, we'll look at what's next for an international fact-finding mission on Iran after it updated the UN on Tehran's repression of domestic protests. And as Iran joins the Shanghai Cooperation Organization founded by China and Russia, a researcher tells us Iran won't see much benefit from the bloc.
It's not like the European Union or NATO, where members enjoy certain privileges such as, you know, either mutual defense or economic integration.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The British government says it plans to ask for parliamentary approval of a new sanctions policy that would allow it to deter Iran from engaging in a wider range of perceived threats to British interests. Until now, London has had to focus its sanctions on Iranian government-affiliated individuals and entities whom it accuses of violating the human rights of Iran's people. British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly told the British Parliament last Thursday that London now wants to sanction Iran for what he called hostile and destabilizing activities in the UK and around the world.
The UK is clear that we need to go further. So today, I am announcing to the House further measures. They constitute a toolkit that I would prefer not to use. But the decision on whether I do so or whether I do not is firmly in the hands of the Iranian regime itself.
Cleverly made no mention of designating or prescribing Iran's top military force, the IRGC, as a terrorist group, as many Iranian rights activists and their allies have been demanding. One of them is Matti Heaven, a British-Iranian politician from the ruling Conservative Party and a director of the International Organization to Preserve Human Rights. I asked her in a Tuesday phone call what she has been doing to campaign for an IRGC designation.
Since the Mahsa Amini death in the last 9 months, my activity has been focused purely on prescription of IRGC. I held 2 events in UK Parliament for the parliamentarians focusing on the threat of IRGC, not only inside of Iran, but here in UK, because there's been 15 attempts of murder and assassination that was reported by MI5 in the last 22 months.
That's the British Intelligence Service.
That's right. And additionally, my husband, as an independent journalist and same time a human rights activist, on the 23rd of February, when he decided that there's not much progress taking place in terms of prescription of IRGC, he attempted and he went on hunger strike for 72 days.
You're referring to your husband, Vahid Beheshti.
Vahid Beheshti, even outside of the Foreign Office. Currently, he's on 139 days of sitting protest, but 72 days of hunger strike followed with 2 weeks being hospitalized, and now he's outside. So to answer your question very clearly, the focus is highlighting the threats and bringing evidence, be it the fact that IRGC is now helping Russia to kill Ukrainians with their drones, the threat to British citizens here, the hostage-taking policy to dual nationals, execution of dual nationals. All of that has been the focus in these months.
Well, given that that has been your focus, specifically trying to get the British government to designate Iran's IRGC as a terrorist organization, that particular step was not included in the latest round of sanctions announced by the British government just last week. There are plans by the government of Rishi Sunak to widen the scope of sanctions against Iran going forward. how do you feel about the British government's latest decision?
It's a step forward. It's a new sanction regime which allows ministers to have a bigger scope in terms of what they do with Iranian regime terror activities and how they can sanction it. So it is a step forward, I would say. However, it is not recognizing them as a terrorist organization, and therefore we still need to continue with our campaign.
The new sanctions regime, as the British government calls it, does need parliamentary approval. Can you explain to our audience, given also your role in British domestic politics as a member of the ruling Conservative Party, what actions can we expect as the British government tries to get this approved?
I believe that because back in January, there was a non-binding resolution on prescription of IRGC, and it was voted on all cross-party. So this would be welcomed, and it would be voted on. This is my personal thoughts, that the parliamentarians would want this to go ahead. However, as we're saying, the parliamentarians' ultimate goal and the messages about when the government's going to prescribe IRGC. We had over 125 MPs and peers cross-party in April in support of my husband's hunger strike, wrote to our prime minister just on that reason of prescription of IRGC. But with regards to the support of this new regime, I would imagine this would be welcomed.
What are the prospects of the British government adopting the step that you have been advocating for, actually prescribing or designating the IRGC as a terrorist organization?
The prospect, this is why we are here and we are continuing to campaign. The reality is that the British government need to show which side that they are supporting. Are they side for the people of Iran or people who are killing the people of Iran? So the IRGC is known fact that they are supporting and funding Hezbollah and Hamas, and Hezbollah and Hamas both are in the list of terrorist organizations in the UK. The way we see that IRGC is the mother of Hezbollah and Hamas. So therefore, this should be the right step forward. And that's the question that we are now asking, why this is not done sooner.
Well, actually, your husband recently tweeted that whenever the British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly is asked, why are you not designating the IRGC, he says, well, we want to make sure to keep our British nationals safe here in the UK and abroad. It seems like he's hinting at the possibility that Iran might retaliate violently in some way and harm British nationals if the UK were to take that step. What do you think?
Well, there already have been 15 attempts of assassination. So the attempts, already we have evidence enough that there are threats to our safety here in Britain. So what more actions can we see from them? They already are terrorists. And so how can we not recognize their activity as it is? So I think what it is that we should step away from appeasement policy. The appeasement policy historically hasn't worked. Iran is the type of regime that only understand the language of pressure, and they need to be isolated internationally. That's the language, so that in order for them to change their behavior. Obviously, the Iranian regime is not happy currently with these new sanctions taking place, but we need to stand really strong. We need to show the Iranian regime and British government need to act so that they understand that we are not appeasing them.
Well, Matti Heaven, director of the International Organization to Preserve Human Rights, on the line from Coventry in the UK. Nice of you to be with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
A team of human rights experts appointed by the UN to investigate Iran's suppression of anti-government protests that erupted last September presented an oral update of its findings to the UN Human Rights Council on July 5th. The Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Iran called for Tehran to ensure accountability for alleged human rights violations related to the nationwide protests, including prosecuting and punishing those responsible and providing reparations to the victims. Iran's delegate at the council accused Western nations of fomenting the protests and dismissed the fact-finding mission as politically motivated and working with unreliable sources. Reporter Lisa Schlein monitored the event from Geneva, where the council is based. I asked her by phone what she found most interesting about it.
I think what is really important about the oral update that was given and the subsequent answers to questions at the end was that it kind of gave a larger impression about the situation of what is occurring in Iran. And it was impressive in terms of the scale and the scope and the brutality and also the blatant cruelty of the violations that were committed by the Iranian security forces, especially against the women and girls. We get a lot of reporting about this, and it's good reporting on what is happening in Iran. But this was something that was pretty concentrated, and it went from one, shall I say, terrifying issue situation to another. So it painted a portrait that was pretty horrifying in many respects.
Now, the fact-finding mission's final report is due by March 2024. What steps do you anticipate from this mission in the coming months? For example, will we get another oral update before that final report is out?
No other oral update is anticipated. I think we won't hear anything from them until they do submit their final report. But they will be extremely busy. One of the things that came out of the report that they submitted to the council at this session was that they had made repeated requests to the Iranian government for permission to access the country and to do their investigation, to meet with witnesses and victims and so forth. And they were repeatedly refused. And this, of course, is a big handicap in terms of their ability to get the information that they need. And so they will continue to do this and hope that they get a more positive response. However, anticipating that this might not be the case, they've got other means of accessing witnesses and victims. They didn't go into detail about that. And a lot of that had to do with security issues because this is a very sensitive issue. And many of these people are threatened. In fact, one of the points that they made in their report was that the Iranian government was harassing and intimidating, threatening journalists, family members of people who have been imprisoned. And so it's not easy to talk. So they will be trying to figure out how to get their information by other means. And I suppose some of this might have to do with satellite imagery and speaking to a lot of people who are outside of Iran, and probably their ability to, in some particular manner, talk or get information from people who are inside the country.
It's certainly a challenge. What would you say is the overall significance of this exercise?
I think one of the things that's most important about this is that there was a lot of media interest right after Mahsa Amini died in custody and the protests erupted. This was very dramatic. Since then, unfortunately, Iran no longer makes headline news. The world has moved on. There are other crises happening in the world, and so they've gone away. And what the fact-finding mission does with its report and ongoing efforts to investigate this situation is that they are once again putting the limelight, shining the light on Iran, making the public, the international community, sit up and take notice and understand that this is not a good government. It's a terrible government. And one thing that we've learned throughout the years is that governments, no matter how terrible they are and how strong they are, take China as an example, will do cartwheels, will do whatever it takes in order not to be examined or come under the investigative limelight of the UN Human Rights Council, because they don't like the publicity. They really get hurt by this. Now, another thing that is very important for this investigation that's going on is that the mission will be collecting evidence that will be preserved and be available for use in the future for possible international prosecutions. This has happened in the past with other investigations, and they're hoping that this will happen in this kind of a situation. And one other thing, there is this problem of safety and security. It's a big issue, and many people have to leave Iran for their own safety, and some are able to do so. So it's important that the international community remains apprised of this issue and provides them with the international protection that these people need.
Reporter Lisa Schlein, thank you very much for joining us again on Flashpoint Iran from Geneva.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran notched another foreign policy achievement this month, becoming the 9th member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Founded by China and Russia in 2001, SCO's members also include Central Asian states, Kazakhstan, the Kyrgyz Republic, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, as well as India and Pakistan. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi marked Iran's new role by participating in a virtual summit on July 4th. Nicole Graevsky is an international security researcher at the Harvard Kennedy School. I asked her by phone what benefit Iran might see from joining the bloc.
Well, in terms of benefits, the SCO offers very little. It's not like the European Union or NATO, where members enjoy certain privileges, such as, you know, either mutual defense or economic integration. The SCO really functions as kind of this ad hoc organization that meets with several forums. And so on the side, Iran has the opportunity to engage with a lot of the Central Asian states, with Russia, with China, India, and Pakistan. But in terms of the actual institutional benefits, they're quite marginal. There is some sides of it that actually have to do with regime security and repression that Iran may benefit from. The SCO maintains a list of outlawed organizations and kind of terrorist groups that fall under the three evils, as they say, which is terrorism, extremism, and separatism. And so in essence, the states of the SCO have to also recognize those groups as outlawed organizations.
When it comes to Iran's engagement with SCO members, you know, Iran has been associated with the organization for quite some time before becoming a full member. What does that engagement look like in practice?
Yes, so the engagement of the SCO, because it's not as robust as an institution as, you know, many of its European equivalents, it really is done on a basis where, you know, foreign ministers of the respective countries will meet beforehand and plan out kind of what the discussions will be at this big summit that they have annually. And there will be a plenary session where they kind of vote on various proposals that were discussed beforehand. Iran was an observer state before it achieved membership status. And so observer states didn't have the opportunity to vote on various amendments or resolutions or kind of initiatives that the SCO was pushing. Now Iran can do that. One of the difficult sides of the SCO, especially when it comes to the organization, is that it's governed by consensus. So that means that all states essentially have to agree on whatever goes forward. So Iran will have that ability. I mean, the summits are important because they allow these countries to come together and kind of coordinate, but there's no formal mechanism beyond this plenary session that they have that allows them to do so.
Well, you've written before that Iran benefits from association with the SCO in terms of political solidarity with other members. Can you think of an example of how this political solidarity helps it to, you know, withstand pressure from the West?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a very specific type of solidarity, and it's something that resonates in a lot of the SCO countries. And that's really domestic upheaval. And that began with the color revolutions and a lot of the Central Asian states' concern about Western democracy pressures, also Russia and China. And so that evolved into, you know, a lot of the times SEO states, whenever there's any kind of interference in their domestic affairs, they'll come out and, you know, say that this is not within the principles of the SEO. We are against this. This is external interference, and kind of tout that narrative. And Iran even benefited from that prior to its membership in the SEO. During the Green Movement, the SEO was very resolute in actually coming out, mostly led by Russia and at the time Tajikistan, coming out and saying that the Green Movement protests, you know, this was external interference.
And that was in 2009 in Iran.
Yeah, that was in 2009. And also in terms of present day, a lot of the times when there are tensions with Iran and the West, and this was seen after the assassination of Soleimani, where a lot of the SEO states actually had phone calls with Iran, you know, stressing, you know, de-escalation of tensions, calling this assassination a catalyst to potentially lead to far more destabilizing consequences.
Yes, and Soleimani was the head at the time of the IRGC Quds Force.
Yes, and then he was assassinated at the very beginning of 2020 in Iraq. And for the Central Asian states, this obviously caused a bit of concern because it was a flashpoint that could eventually lead to some kind of tension between the U.S. and Iran. And in general, the SEO has been supportive of a diplomatic solution to the Iranian nuclear issue. And we've seen that, you know, even in 2013, 2015, I mean, the first statement from the SEO that came out in support of the JCPOA negotiations, or what led to the JCPOA negotiations, was around 2013, I believe. And this really stressed a diplomatic solution. So in many ways, the SEO provides Iran with some kind of cover for some of its affairs, but it's not something that's always translated into policy. And so I guess the solidarity is in many ways virtual. It's kind of, you know, it's there, but it's not with much substance.
So we talked a bit about what Iran gets out of the SEO, but what do other SEO members get out of Iran being admitted into their club?
I mean, the organization has lost a lot of its significance, and I think it's partly because of disagreements between Russia and China over the fate of the organization, but also the inclusion of India and Pakistan, which really made it less of a cohesive bloc. So Iran's membership in some ways is symbolic. It benefits the organization for saying that it has a wider geographic reach. Also, I mean, a lot of the narratives around the SEO by SEO member states point to its potential for economic connectivity, and Iran's a huge node in that. But there's not a lot in terms of actual benefits for the SEO members with Iran's membership beyond this symbolic significance. That being said, Iran does have a lot of experience fighting domestic separatist groups. It has experience with counterterrorism operations, and that became important around the time of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. So some of these capacity building aspects of it could be quite important. But it's not the same thing as saying that, you know, a new country joined the European Union where there would be actual economic benefits for the member states. And so that's, I think, the real distinction. It's not as robust or bureaucratic as most organizations.
Well, given that lack of robustness, how do you think the West is going to respond to Iran joining with this kind of discussion forum in the SEO? How much concern do you think there would be in the West about Iran's membership?
Well, there was definitely concern with the Ahmadinejad administration, and there was pressure from the U.S. On China in particular about, you know, inviting Iran to join, because Iran actually initially applied in 2008. And there was concern that it'd be used as a platform to legitimize a lot of Ahmadinejad's views, especially towards its nuclear program. And consequently, the SEO did enact a kind of a membership criteria that said no states under UN sanctions can join. Obviously, Iran's not under UN sanctions anymore. So that kind of opened the way for that. And there's very little at this point, I think, that the U.S. can do. And I'm not sure if it's as much of a concern within like the minds of policymakers, just partly because this organization really lacks any kind of substance. But it does provide Iran with a new venue of states that it can, you know, outreach in terms of its foreign policy. And that is significant for Iran, I think.
Well, Nicole Graevsky, international security researcher at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, speaking to us from Puglia in Italy. Thank you for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.